It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a look at the stigma of mental illness after reports that the Washington, D.C. Navy Yard shooter heard voices and may have showed other signs of mental illness.
First, officials in Wisconsin are trying to keep closer tabs on people looking to rent out rooms and entire houses to tourists. Popular websites have made the process easier than ever. As Brianne Shasso reports, these short-term rentals present both challenges and opportunities for the communities that have them.
When Kyle Pfister lived in Madison, he would travel often for work. Rather than leave his apartment empty, he would rent it out to people visiting Madison using Airbnb, a website that lists short-term rentals ranging from shared rooms to entire homes. He says renting his living space this way allowed him to share his love for his neighborhood and the city with others.
I mean, I could sort of be their little guide when they were staying here in Madison. So it was a fantastic experience for me.
Pfister also says there's a financial component as well. He says it's a way to make some extra money. But the arrangement exists in something of a legal gray area. It technically falls under a section of state law that addresses tourist rooming houses, which are required to have health permits and pay room tax. But on the local level, they often go unregulated. That, however, is starting to change. Communities, sensing that they may be losing out on potential tax money, are making an effort to pass and enforce regulations. In Madison, Alders have proposed an ordinance that will place requirements on tourist rooming houses in the city. Alder Mark Clear says the spaces are neither allowed nor prohibited under current zoning law.
What we're trying to do is create a framework where there's clear lines about what's legal and what isn't so that people can do it legally and responsibly.
Clear says that when the city counted the number of these spaces a couple of months ago, there were around 100, although he suspects it may have doubled by now.
Popularity is growing so fast, it's hard to keep track.
For Madison, the next step in the process is a public meeting in September. The proposed ordinance requires hosts to get a conditional use permit for the city and pay room tax. Under the plan, a permit applicant must also be the owner of the space. Other communities in the state have already taken a look at this type of housing. For example, Green Bay has a similar ordinance on the books, and there are some spaces with a permit near Lambeau Field. In Door County, a commission called the Door County Tourism Zone is also making an effort to regulate short-term rentals. Chairman Josh Van Lieshout says the commission actively searches for short-term rentals without a permit. Websites like Airbnb are part of that search. When a space without a permit is found, the owner is contacted about getting one and paying room tax.
We have a very open, very proactive permitting process. We try not to punish people. We want them to comply. That's how we approach it.
Van Lieshout says the effort involved is worth it. In Door County, room tax goes to marketing the area and to municipalities within the zone. Brianne Shasso, Wisconsin Public Radio News.
Thanks to Brianne for that report. News outlets are reporting that suspected Navy Yard shooter Aaron Alexis had mental problems and heard voices. He's accused of killing 12 people in a shooting spree on Monday morning in Washington, D.C.'s Navy Yard. He was killed in a shootout with police.
Our next guest works on issues related to the stigma that can surround mental illness and how stories like this can affect the way we think about it.
We want you to share your experiences with us. Have you experienced mental illness or someone close to you? Do you think there's a stigma around having it? People look at you differently, think about you differently, treat you differently. Have you or someone close to you ever experienced that kind of stigma? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org.
Sue McKenzie joins us now. She's the director of Rogers in Health and the facilitator for the Wisconsin Initiative for Stigma Elimination, otherwise known as WISE. Sue, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Well, what are some of the assumptions that people make about other people with mental illnesses?
Well, I think I would begin with the assumptions that someone with mental illness makes about themselves. Imagine if today you began to hear voices, what kind of self-talk you would have about that experience. And then imagine how it might be different if you had met people throughout your life who had had the experience of hearing voices or delusions and saw them as people that, you know, learned about their illness, learned how to deal with that, found the right treatment. So then when you began to experience something like a delusion or hearing voices, how different your reaction would be had you had that opportunity to meet and be with people who had also had that experience.
So does that happen very often? I mean, do you think that people can look at a point of reference and say, well, that's similar to this person that I know, or is there something that's holding that back from happening?
Well, I think people that have the opportunity to know people with mental illness are much more likely to take that person's experience into account if they experience a mental illness. But no, I don't think it happens very often. I think that we are a culture of secrecy when it comes to mental illness. Pretty obvious that if I'm a mother and my child falls down and breaks their leg, I'm going to be calling friends and asking for help, and they're going to be dropping by with casseroles. And, you know, if I have a child who suddenly doesn't want to go to school, is too anxious or depressed, and I can't understand it myself, and I haven't experienced it, I'm not likely to be calling my friends and telling them what's going on and asking for help. We tend to keep that a secret too long.
So what you're describing is sort of a culture of isolation around mental illness. So then how do people come out and decide it's time to get help?
Yeah, that's a great question. What we've done at WISE is to begin to learn really from the researchers. And it's amazing, but we actually have researchers across the world that are looking at what works to reduce the stigma. And what they've found is that it is the contact that we have with people with mental illness that helps us to have less stereotypes and prejudice and discrimination. So in order for me to have a contact with someone with a mental illness, that person has to feel like it's a safe environment to talk to me about their experience. And that's a catch-22. I don't understand the mental illness, I may not provide the safe environment that's needed for someone to be able to share their experience with me. So one of the things that we're trying to do is help people to think about their own experiences is kind of gold, and that I have this opportunity, I have a story and experience to share, and how can I share that in a very safe way with a few people so that I can begin to have a community support around me. And, you know, since almost 50% of us are going to experience something like this in our lifetime, the chances are that as we begin to speak to those safe people, we're going to hear stories ourselves as we share ours. The other thing that we're doing at Rogers In Health is filming people who have stories and putting them up free and accessible on our website so that people can go to those stories. They're short, less than 10-minute stories, and begin to share those with others, these experiences of recovery, so that we lessen the fear.
How do you think we're doing with this, you know, storytelling and being honest and coming out to the public? I was in a doctor's office this morning, and I saw People magazine, and I think it was Amanda Bynes talks about her mental illness. And I think a week ago I saw Catherine Zeta-Jones' mental illness struggles. You know, is it becoming something more that, you know, we are talking about as a culture, do you think?
I do think we're talking about it more. I think that, you know, we used to think if we just could get enough celebrities to come out about this, that it would be helpful. And again, if we go back to the research, what we're finding is it really the power of peers that, you know, if I think that you are like me and I hear your story, I'm much less likely to say, oh, she doesn't know, or this couldn't be me, or we're so different. So it's important that people in high profile places share their story. But it's also important that our friends and families and coworkers have safe environments to be able to share their story.
What effect do you think it has when there is, you know, an incident of violent crime like we saw with the Navy Yard shooting and the person involved shows signs of mental illness? What effect does that have on people?
It's really tough, isn't it? The stories, the more we hear them, you know, for me, because of the work I've been really honored to do, I look at those stories and I become curious. You know, I wonder, you know, if this person did in fact, and I don't know the facts in this particular case, but if this person did in fact hear voices, what did that person think of themselves? You know, how did they react? How safe did they feel to share that? And you know, the longer any of us, whatever it is we're dealing with, the longer that we let it go, the tougher it is and the more ingrained it becomes. I mean, I've heard phenomenal stories from young children up through older adults talking about their challenges of mental illness and how ingrained some of the negative thinking about themselves became. But once they kind of opened that door and began to look towards recovery and options with hope and found other people like themselves, they were able to take some really, really amazing steps to live the life that they wanted to lead. So I think it's unfortunate, these stories, because they just point out to me how many people are isolated and isolated way too long.
We're talking right now with Sue McKenzie, director of Rogers In Health and the facilitator for the Wisconsin Initiative for Stigma Elimination, otherwise known as WISE.
We want to hear about your experiences. Do you or someone in your family, your circle of friends have mental illness? Has it been treated like a shameful secret, something that the world shouldn't know about? Or is it something that's talked about and shared with people? Come out of the closet, if I can borrow that phrase from another world. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email, talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and this is Central Time. We're talking right now with Sue McKenzie, director of Rogers In Health and the facilitator for the Wisconsin Initiative for Stigma Elimination.
We're talking about stigma that can surround mental illness, especially with headlines like those about the shooter in the Washington, D.C. Navy Yard. Some reports that he heard voices may have had other signs of mental illness. Want to hear your stories. Do you think there's a stigma? Have you or someone in your family been reluctant to talk about a mental health issue because of it? 800-642-1234 or send an email, talk@WPR.org.
And we'll go to the phones first. We have Pam with us from Wisconsin Dells. Hi, Pam.
Hi.
Hi, what do you think?
Well, my situation with my family is we have a granddaughter who is born out of wedlock, so there's no marriage between my son and the mother, and we did not know the mother previously to become aware of the child being born. Serious mental issues, severe bipolar. I mean, this girl will be up for weeks at a time. She hallucinates at times. She's got a metabolizing problem, so her medication has to be changed like every 3 months. So there's a lot of in and out of the hospital sometimes, and it took like 3 years before we were finally told what the heck was going on, because I'm sure she was scared to tell us because of the stigma of mental illness.
So delaying, right? Yeah, delaying, yeah. Based on, you know, stigma. It takes a longer time for people to get attention.
A long time. And when she didn't know us any better than we knew her, so she was afraid. But now that she's talked to us about it, we all know what's going on. She calls when she needs help. It's so much better now that it's out in the open and we know everything that is wrong. And, you know, she's assured we're not going to try and get her daughter taken away from her.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that call, Pam. Sue, what do you think about that? Is that common that because people are scared to talk about what's going on, that they just delay making things better and getting the treatment they need?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Both a sad story, but also a really helpful story. I mean, how cool that family was able to open their arms around something that it sounds like they didn't know much about and are working towards finding answers, which, you know, I'm confident because, you know, when it comes to mental illness, it really is hopeful. It's not a quick turnaround quite often, and that's something we as a culture have to get used to, that you know, medication can be very helpful. It's not the answer. I had a man tell me one time that, you know, the medication is the leg up for the hard work of healing. And that time that it takes to heal and find what works in recovery, to have that support of that family around that young woman and her child is awesome. I wish them the best.
All right. And the best from house as well. And Pam, thank you for that call. And to AJ in La Crosse. Hi, AJ.
Hello, how are you today?
Doing okay, how are you?
Excellent, thank you.
What do you think? What's your story?
Well, I'm living with bipolar. I've had about every single diagnosis there is. I'm 39. I first became ill when I was 17 when participating in a Civil War reenactment down in Missouri. I went down perfectly sane. He came back requiring 4 months of psychiatric hospitalization. They thought someone had given me some kind of a hallucinogen, and they took my urine samples and didn't find any drug metabolites in my urine and started the trial of neuroleptics. But Clozaril is what helped me to get better. And boy, I would just say for those who are dealing with this issue, just hang in there. Stick with your medicines. It's baby steps day by day. And do the homework of the therapies that will get you better. Because if you don't do them, it's not going to get better. It can be really painful, but it's really good in teaching you how to delay immediate gratification. You can look at it that way. So.
Well, AJ, thank you so much. I appreciate you calling and sharing that and telling your story. Just like Sue was talking about, getting these stories out is so important for people who might be listening. What would you say to AJ, Sue?
Well, first of all, what a great example. You can just feel from him the wisdom that he's gained through a tough road. What a powerful person he can be in other people's lives. If we have environments where he is feeling safe to be able to play that role for others, where he can speak about his experience and not worry about getting fired or being treated differently or not welcomed in a church or wherever, he comes to us as an asset with that level of wisdom. So, yeah, I applaud him.
All right. Well, thanks to AJ for that call. And we move to Cheryl in Radisson. Hi, Cheryl.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I just wanted to say I think a big part of the problem is we're still dealing with old terms like mental illness and, oh, you're mental and stuff like this. And when I was younger, I was having issues with panic attacks and, you know, where I couldn't leave the house and stuff like that. And I went to counselors for it, and my family, it's like, well, you must just be lonely and need someone to talk to. They couldn't understand how simply talking to someone could help. And, oh, you must be crazy and keep an eye on her, and, you know, something's wrong with her. Well, just coincidentally, when I was 30, I ended up having to have a hysterectomy, and the second I did, all the other issues went away, and it was determined that this whole time it had been a chemical imbalance in my body. And the doctor that I was seeing at the time had said that, yeah, he wishes they could call it, instead of mental illness, a chemical imbalance or something like that, because then people look at it more as a physical issue rather than, oh, you're just crazy.
Okay, well, that's
interesting. Especially, and especially since most illnesses, they do put you on some sort of a medication. So obviously, there must be something chemically off kilter.
All right. Thank you so much for that comment, Cheryl. That's interesting. Now, she's talking about maybe changing the word we have for it, mental illness, and that maybe we should move toward chemical imbalance. I would think that, you know, ascribing it as something that's just happening in the body, an illness like cancer or diabetes would be the same kind of thing, and maybe we would treat it the same, but maybe it's not so. What is your take on that, Sue?
You know, I've been in many conversations with people about the right word for this experience, and I don't have an answer for the right word. For me, it's what's the right attitude that we approach the experience with, and I tend lately to more ask the person who's living it what they want, how they want to define it. I had a wonderful young man that I interviewed who I was about to put his story on the website and ask him about the label that he wanted. And he actually came back to me and said, you know, I find support without labels, so I don't want you to label me. And so he's actually on our website as Michael or M without a label. And so I think we're struggling with the language around this. I'm comfortable with mental illness because I don't see it as the threat that many people do, and I understand why some people see it as a threat because they haven't experienced recovery and the reality of recovery as much, so they feel a little more fear around that. So if someone wants to call it mental health or a chemical imbalance, I'm fine with that.
Well, Sue, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, and thank you so much for covering this subject.
We're talking with Sue McKenzie. She's director of Rogers in Health and the facilitator for the Wisconsin Initiative for Stigma Elimination, or WISE. And if you'd like to comment on this, maybe weigh in with your thoughts about the term mental illness and how comfortable you are with that, or maybe you just want to tell your story and get it out there for people to see, you can do so on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, is turquoise the average color of the universe? We'll find out the answer to that and other weird facts about color.
But first, we'll visit the Arctic. Our next guest says declining ice levels are opening the door to resource development and transportation. And he says conservationists need to get in on the action.
Jeffrey Paris joins us now. He's the World Wildlife Fund's Senior Director of Conservation Resources. We have a link to an article he wrote on the Central Time Facebook page. Jeffrey, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Is the door to the Arctic open economically in a way it wasn't even as recently as a couple decades ago?
Oh, absolutely. It's a race in like the Wild West. Right now, the Arctic sea ice has receded to a point where we thought it would be at 2050. Last time I checked, today is 2013. So this is way ahead of time, much faster than we predicted. And so now we're seeing this door open much faster and a lot of people rushing in for everything from transportation shipping routes to oil and gas exploration to mining. And so now conservationists are on our heels, and we're saying we need to hop in there and be smart about what happens to the future of the Arctic.
So this isn't hypothetical or science fiction. There's actually, for part of the year, shipping going through places that ships would never have gone before.
Absolutely. In fact, that is so true. And right now we're seeing, for example, the Russian Federation has created a whole agency for the Northern Sea Route, which is a brand new route that will cut off a lot of the distance necessary to get ships and goods from the Atlantic to the Pacific. They're already at this. They're already moving these ships through with lots of goods, and actually 85% of that is oil and gas already. So this is not fiction. It's very much fact.
What kind of wildlife and ecosystems are in this region?
Well, you know, there's a famous quote about the Arctic being called a great white nothingness by a politician, and that's probably the farthest from the truth. The Arctic ice, let's just talk about the ice for a second, that great whiteness, is as rich as, in some measures, as places like the Amazon. It is host to polar bears, to whales, to seals, to seabirds, to all kinds of small organisms that keep that whole ecosystem alive, called phytoplankton, and even things like walruses. We're seeing, if you visit worldwildlife.org today, you'll see a story about evidence of what's happening with the sea ice disappearing. We've just seen about 4,000 walruses end up on the shores on land because there is no sea ice available to them at this time of year. And in the process, we're seeing them starving. We're seeing them trampling their young. This is not normal. And unfortunately, this has become the new normal of the Arctic.
And that's as a consequence of the sea ice going away. What additional impacts are you worried about as we see more shipping and more mineral oil exploration there?
That's a great question, Rob. So there are those direct impacts where you essentially are losing habitat, just like you would, you know, we talk often about the felling of the Amazon. That's the same thing that's going on. But we're also worried about what happens when these new resource uses start to come in. There's a series of these really challenging impacts. So, for example, as ships are coming through, they're producing all kinds of pollution. We don't know how to clean that up in the Arctic. Should there be an oil spill from an actual oil tanker? And you'll remember I said 85% of the shipping that is going on in the Arctic right now is carrying oil and gas. If that spills, we do not know, as a species, how to clean it up. And, you know, many companies are starting to realize that this is going to be a challenge. We don't know what to do with that risk. And so World Wildlife Fund feels that, you know, we're not against this shipping, but we feel like we need to be in a better position to be able to do it in a very smart way. And right now, there is no way to do it smartly.
So what do you, as a conservationist, want to see happen there? As you say, you don't want to shut the door to all this economic activity, and probably the door is open wide enough you couldn't shut it. What are you hoping to do? Wildlife areas, a sanctuary zone? What would it take?
Yep. Essentially, we have used, as we always have, the best available science, we and many of our partners in the conservation community, to identify what we're calling these Arctic jewels, these places which, should they be exploited unsustainably, should they be lost, that we will lose all the pieces of the Arctic ecosystem that that many of these wildlife depend on, and I'd say also many of us depend on to put fish onto our dinner plates. So there are those places that are really, really important that do need to be protected. Now, protection doesn't mean you wall it off. It means that at certain times in certain places in the Arctic over the course of the year, you just want to be smart. Some activities shouldn't happen in certain places, and others they can happen at a certain degree. So it's setting these new rules for what can be done where in the Arctic, and that roadmap is really one of the first solutions that we are working with indigenous peoples and companies, the private sector, to come to some agreement on around what that roadmap should look like in this new normal of a warming Arctic.
One specific thing you mentioned in your piece is whale migration and the impacts that shipping might have on it. What kind of specific things could we do to have shipping go through that area but not interfere with whales?
Yeah, so this is a great question. And, you know, this is going to be a challenge that we have to confront, so we just have to be smarter. One thing that we can do is, just like if I spend a lot of time in the air and I know about the air traffic control system, right? Well, you can have the same system, an air traffic control system for the seas. And that system, which has also been piloted, we know it works in places like the New England area and around Puget Sound, can basically help ships steer clear of very sensitive areas, particularly during whale migrations. So that's one way where technology could help us. There are other ways where we simply alter the actual shipping routes for two reasons. One is to prevent pollution should there be a spill, and we are seeing spills happen all the time. But the other way is the other reason we would do that is to keep another type of pollution, noise pollution, which is what these whales depend on to find their mates, to find their food, and they are essentially being deafened by the shipping and oil and gas exploration. So those are some of the things that we could do, just being smarter about when and how these things happen.
One interesting thing in your piece, speaking of piloting programs, this is a whole new region of the world that we're kind of stepping into here. And you make the case that, hey, maybe this is a laboratory where we can learn lessons on how to have economic activity alongside nature and then apply those lessons elsewhere in the world. Talk about that a little.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this is the article refers to really exploration 2.0, if you will. This is kind of the new frontier where we're going to have to be a lot smarter as a species if we want to be able to have all the benefits that these ecosystems give us. It's going to take several things that we're seeing in the Arctic. It's going to take important policies and regulations, which is something that some people like and some people don't, but we definitely are going to have other partnerships with things like the private sector, with companies sitting down next to an indigenous person from the Arctic or next to an environmental nonprofit, finding solutions that work, that balance those economic needs, those cultural needs of indigenous people, and the ecological needs that sustain us all. And I think a lot of those lessons and that sort of partnership within boundaries is going to be something that we are applying in other parts of the world. And I think that that is the new frontier. That's the other kind of new exploration, just as the exploration is happening in the Arctic. And that's what gives me hope that we can find those kinds of solutions that work.
Looking at past resource rushes, whether you're talking about a gold rush or
right.
an oil rush, usually the economics comes first, and worrying about environmental issues, if it ever comes much later. Do you think that people are thinking differently enough now that an Arctic resource rush and shipping rush would be done differently than pretty much any other time in history?
Well, I think, when times get tough, we see people think about how they balance out their resource use. We saw that with the economic downturn. People realize, whoa, I need to save more. And that same kind of scenario is happening right now. I think, times are tough right now. We're seeing the effects of using more planet than we have. We have essentially overdrawn our bank account for the planet and the resources it provides us, and realizing that that has some serious ramifications in terms of storms and weather impacts, in terms of depleted fisheries, And so I think we are getting smarter. The real question is not will we be smarter, but can we be smart enough soon enough? And that's one of the things that we're doing at World Wildlife Fund is trying to raise that level of awareness and make that tie to Americans and to people around the world so that we realize why the ecology matters.
Jeffrey, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
That was Jeffrey Parrish, the World Wildlife Fund's Senior Director of Conservation Resources. We've got his article on the Arctic linked on the Central Time Facebook page.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later on Central Time, we'll share some movies worth watching and rewatching and hear your suggestions, too.
First, we're going to explore the world of color. It's something we're surrounded by, but we don't often take the time to really think about it.
Color helps us make sense of the world. It gives meaning to the objects around us. It can evoke strong emotions, good and bad, but why? What is it about color that affects us so much?
Joining us now is Jude Stewart, contributing editor for Print. She writes about design and culture for numerous publications, and her book is called Roy G. Biv, an exceedingly surprising book about color. Jude, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Well, the first question that you raise in your book is why a book about color? So why?
Well, you know, it's just as you guys said in the intro, you know, color is so ubiquitous that it really rapidly becomes invisible. So I was interested in kind of capturing those moments where suddenly color is visible again. So there's a lot of different moments in life where that might happen, where you know somebody wears the wrong color to a funeral, or you paint a room a color that you realize is horrible as soon as the room is done. So those are the kind of mundane experiences that bring color to the fore. But you know, I wanted to collect a lot of fun and smart and, you know, indeed surprising stories about color, so that, you know, we could see all the different meanings that it has.
Is it actually, you know, kind of hard to define what color is?
Yeah, you know, I found a book that actually defines that color in scientific terms has 15 different meanings, which I am not going to relate right now. So, yeah, it's a lot harder to pin down than I realized. But, you know, for the purposes of the book, I kind of focused on things, the sort of aspects of color that you know, kind of impinge on ordinary life. So, you know, it's happening. Color is a perception thing that's happening in our brains. It's happening in our eyes. So if you're colorblind, you're having a different experience of the world than the rest of us. You know, it's happening to some degree out there in the world, and it's dependent on, you know, illumination, the light in the room. Even the colors that are next to a color can impact how that color looks. So, you know, I could try to keep it at that level, but it goes much deeper even than that.
Well, and it can be one of those philosophical things too, can't it? I mean, am I seeing the same blue that you're seeing, for instance, or are you seeing something completely different? We have no way of knowing. I know definitely that seems to be the case with me and my husband sometimes.
Yeah, I've had that experience too, right? Yeah, it does provoke a lot of deep questions. And at the same time, the thing that I didn't mention here that's probably the most important aspect of color is culture. So, you know, we're walking around in the world seeing color and reading certain things into it because of the things that are that color. So, you know, red is, it might connote a lobster and has certain, you know, associations of elitism, but it also is a communist color. So that's a very worker democratic sort of notion. And if I'm from a totally different culture, I might be thinking very different things about red. So, you know, in China, for example, there are these things called red egg and ginger parties for babies. So you will literally dye eggs, hard-boiled eggs, a red color, and bring them to the party to celebrate a new baby. So the idea is, you know, red is auspicious and it's bringing that sense of hope and luck. So, you know, the culture is bringing that to the color. And, you know, that's what I'm trying to do, is sort of stir the pot, if you will, of a color and see all the different things that will come up.
Well, and to use another example of that, in your section on the color yellow, you have some really funny quotes. And there's one by Alfred Hitchcock, which we'll get to, but also one where an artist is speaking with a reporter, and the reporter says, "Why did you choose orange as the color for the gates?" And the artist says, "Saffron, saffron, they are saffron." We get really attached to our notions of color.
Absolutely. In fact, throughout the book, I gathered a lot of quotes from people who are, you know, both famous and obscure. But the through line on the quotes is that it's some really strongly felt opinion about color or belief. And boy, it's really easy to find those. We all feel strongly, whether we realize it or not, about color.
Well, why do you think that is? I mean, it begs the question, why do we get so worked up about colors?
Oh, gosh, if I knew that, you know, I wouldn't have had to write a book. You would think at the end of the book I would know that. But, I'm not entirely sure. Your guess is as good as mine. But I think it has to do with this combination of
the sort of rational side of color and the things we can know about it and the things, again, that are in our world that carry certain colors, and then the emotional side. There's a very long and literally centuries long debate between painters between the notion of color and line, so whether or not one is more important than the other in a painting. And the general feeling there is that color is emotion and the kind of more primal side of our nature, and that line is the rational, cool, clinical kind of thinking side of our nature. And, you know, obviously those two are a complementary pair and sometimes in opposition. So I think it's just, you know, both sides of our brain are engaged with color.
Well, I want to dive into some of the stories you tell, because that's what most of this book is, sort of stories about associations of color. And, you know, to stick with yellow, do you remember that Alfred Hitchcock quote?
Oh, yes. I love that. He says he never eats, if I remember correctly, he never eats the yolks of eggs because he finds them just horrifying. And he describes them in this very Hitchcockian manner, that the yellow specifically of the yolks is so awful. Do you have the quote in front of you?
I do, actually. It says, let's see, I'm frightened of eggs, worse than frightened. They revolt me. That white round thing without any holes. Blood is jolly red, but egg yolk is yellow revolting. I've never tasted it.
Exactly. I mean, I guess he's a bacon man. I don't know.
I'm not surprised by that somehow. Well, tell us some other colors, stories about colors. Green is a particularly rich one, I think.
Yeah, you know, in green, I was surprised to find that there are so many stories around the notions of green being a lucky color or being a very unlucky color. And that was something that kind of cut across different cultures, different contexts. I mean, once I found that, I just became a game of, you know, trying to find more stories that kind of hewed to that. So to give you some examples, green cars are considered unlucky. Green magazine covers tend to be called newsstand poison. So the idea is if you make a magazine cover that is predominantly green, it's not going to sell.
Interesting.
The one I really like is in China, men do not wear green hats because the phrase wearing a green hat in Chinese apparently sounds just like the phrase to be cuckolded, so to have your wife cheat on you. So, you know, wearing the green hat is sort of saying my wife is cheating on me. So those are not... Those are not so popular in China. So that's the unlucky side of things. And then the lucky side, I explored things like why are dollar bills green. Islam has a very warm and positive feeling about green. It's full of luck and auspiciousness and the color of Muhammad. And then there are a couple other things there. And then there are some that don't really fit into either luck or its opposite. So if it was good enough, I included that too.
Well, why are dollar bills green?
Why are dollar bills green? Well, you know, this is an example of one of those stories that they give an answer, and at the same time, it's a little bit about the myths that kind of spool around it. The answer is not really satisfying, but why people talk about that answer as being true is more the interesting thing. So, you know, what happened is initially there were dollar bills were representative of gold that you had at home. So I think they were introduced during the Civil War. So you would have a dollar bill that said, here's my, you know, IOU for the gold that I have at home. And those were printed in any color and then gradually systematized to green. And when I looked this up on the Fed's website, it says, green is a color that indicates solidity, and you know it's just a bunch of stuff that you could have guessed, and I'm not entirely sure. At the same time, one of the things I've learned about green is that it's very difficult to print a green accurately. So there's often a mismatch between what you think you're getting and what you actually get. So it could be that as they perfected the notion of printing green, that, you know, this is a sort of method against counterfeiting. So, you know, a little bit fact, a little bit lore on that one. I wouldn't swear by that, but that is something I've come across that I thought seemed plausible.
Is there a color that, you know, among all these colors, people are the most divided about, or either they passionately love it or they passionately hate it?
Well, you know, I feel like the color black has kind of come in for a bad rap. So when I was looking into that color, I walked in with the notions that everybody has about that color, that it's negative, that it's evil, that it's midnight, and tried to find sort of a lot of positive sides to that color. So to give you a few examples, there are people in present-day Iraq called the Uruk who think of black as being very a sign of fertility. So these are desert people. So if you think about it, you know, black soil is a sign of a recent rain, and that's really what makes sense as an association. It's not something we think about in this part of the world where we get lots of rain. So I was trying to go through with black and sort of find its sunnier side, if you will. Another example is in Arthurian legend, when you have a black knight, that is usually a sign of somebody who is incognito and generally a good guy. So you think of the black knight, you know, we think of black hat, white hat, and the black hat's always the bad guy. But in Arthurian legend, the knight wearing black is generally good and is, for whatever reason, wishing to remain unknown.
Interesting. Well, do you have a favorite story in this book about color that you like to tell?
Well, I really like the one about the average color of the universe, which is something that a friend of mine introduced to me, who's a physicist. So there were a bunch of astronomers who were gathered at a conference, and this team of astronomers had done a study about the we're looking into the average age of the universe, so they're looking at something like 200,000 stars. And as you probably know, the color of a star is a tip-off to its age, so it goes through different color shifts over the course of its life. So they were looking primarily at these colors to figure out the age of the universe, but then while they were, you know, done with their kind of meat and potatoes work, they thought it would be a fun postscript to calculate the average color of the universe as well and introduce this in the conference. So, you know, with great fanfare, they said, "The color is da-da-da, turquoise." And, you know,
I bet the other scientists love that.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, so my friend was at this conference, and he said, you know, one of the running conference jokes was that people would be in the middle of a conversation and say, "Oh, I was talking to this woman in a turquoise dress, and she just disappeared into the universe." But, But then the funny thing is that another scientist later on looked into this a little more deeply. He was a color scientist in the Rochester Institute of Technology, and he ran the numbers again and made a good case for the fact that it was not turquoise. And so his case made the color a different one, which is beige.
Like turquoise so much better.
Yeah. Oh, you think it's better? Yeah.
That's so much better than beige. Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah, I know. It's a little sad, I guess.
All right. Well, Jude, it's been fun. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Jude Stewart. Her new book is called Roy G. Biv, an exceedingly surprising book about color.